Welcome back, everyone. So this is the time for Dhamma reflection. My name again is Venerable Dhammadipa. I go by she, her pronouns. And our topic today is right mindfulness, the seventh of the eight aspects, cords or threads of the Noble Path, the Eightfold Noble Path. So before I get into my talk, I'd like to go ahead and pay homage to the Triple Gem. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. Mindfulness. There is so much that has been said about mindfulness already. Time magazine mindfulness special edition at the grocery store checkout. That was my most recent surprise. And there is still quite a bit that could be said about mindfulness, so hopefully I will be able to share something with you. But I'd like to start, first of all, with a story. A story about many years ago when I was a monastic in Japan. So in Japan, the practice of alms collection is called takuhatsu. And in the fall, we go on aki takuhatsu, fall takuhatsu. It means going out to the 27 or so sub-temples of the larger training monastery that I lived in, and going and visiting all these little towns in rural Japan, and visiting them, and chanting at literally every doorstep in those little towns, and chanting the Heart Sutra, and collecting dana. And one day we were out, and so we go out in groups, usually everybody except the person who is staying back to cook, or sometimes also the office person, but generally everybody would go, and it's a small monastery, so we'd go out about 20 of us in groups of four. And for whatever reason this day, we had split up into a couple of towns. And so there I was, one of two groups of four. And we were in this small village. And most Japanese rural villages are fairly compact. The houses are fairly close together. And so are the streets. The streets were sometimes so small that it was hard to tell, like, what was a street for cars and what was a walking path for people. But in this particular town, it was the other way. We were in this town that had these like very long winding roads, and the houses were kind of separate, like these big tentacles of an octopus coming out, like just random, seemingly, roads. And anyway, we got there in the morning and started coming to, you know, going door to door as we were doing usually. And nobody had answered the door at numerous places that I'd been. So I'd already been to a whole block full of places, and nobody was answering the door. And usually that would be kind of no fun, because then I don't get to see the people. But on this day, I thought, well, it's a beautiful day outside, and so I'm just going to enjoy the weather and walk these nice, long, windy streets and make my way and not worry about getting lost, which was the usual situation for me. of getting lost or having to find my group, having my group have to find me. But on this day, I wasn't worried about that at all. And so there I was. So we have this bell that we ring. I should have brought it with me, actually, from upstairs. This very, very loud bell that we ring as we're going along so that people know that we're around and that we're in the neighborhood. And so I was ringing the bell and listening to the sound of it, and I was enjoying the sunshine, the light. It's fall, so it's very nice, crisp, cool temperatures on my skin, and feeling the ground under my feet. So we hand wove these little sandals that we walk in, and even, you know, how that fall air even has kind of a nice, crisp, clean taste to it. So there I was walking, and I looked to my right, and to my right there was a rice paddy. Now, maybe some of you have traveled in that part of the world, you might know, or in other parts of Asia, you might know, like, rice paddies are everywhere. In rural Japan, they're everywhere, literally. I'd probably seen thousands and thousands already in my short time that I'd been in Japan. Probably at that point about a year or so. Yeah, part of that is because people grow rice even in their very small plots. If they have a small home with a small plot of land, they'll grow rice for their family. But I looked to my right and there was a rice paddy, and I was captivated. Like, all of a sudden, it was these beautiful colors, this citron green and then emerald and then gold and then... And the light was kind of dappled because there's a little bit of clouds, and so it would, like, and they were swaying in the breeze, this fall breeze that was happening, these stalks of rice. So the rice paddies, maybe you know, are sort of covered in a little bit of water. There's a little bit of water, standing water at the base of it, and then it's a long little stalk like this, and then the rice is actually at the end of the stalk, and so the stalks tend to move in the breeze. And this was just the most gorgeous thing I'd ever seen. I stopped walking and I just looked and absorbed this scene for a little while. And then noticed again behind that paddy there was this little bit of a hill, like a mountain, and the brown of the hill coming forth and so on. Anyway, I was stood there for quite a while looking at this and taking it all in. And it wasn't until later that I realized that that what had happened in that moment was that that was just a moment of very, very crisp mindfulness. That was just a moment in which, because I had been tuned into my senses, right? So I was aware of the light, and I was listening to the sound, and I was feeling the temperature, and I was smelling the air and tasting the air and all of these things, that I had this moment of experiencing what Ajahn Brahm speaks about, of the bliss of the mindfulness of just a regular everyday moment. So even looking at this thing, this rice paddy, which is no big deal, it's a rice paddy, was incredibly compelling and joyful, and so clear that I still remember it to this day. That was 2006 or 2007. I still remember the colors of that particular rice paddy and the movement of the thing. Not because I'm anybody special, but because that is the nature of the compelling experience that we have of the world in a moment of deep mindfulness. And I think that up until that point, so I'd been practicing a long, long time by that point. I'd been practicing about 19 years at that point. And that up until that moment, I think that I had looked at most things in my life, if not everything, as if I already knew it. As if I already knew it, you know? Or sometimes later on I would reflect on when you are around small children and they are learning about the world, they have a kind of awe and a kind of observation, right? And they'll see things that you have just completely overlooked. But they're experiencing that with great care. So I'd lost that feeling for a very, 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 very long time until that moment of the rice paddy in Japan. So this story is intended to put into context a little bit about the potential for mindfulness. It's not that every single practice, every single moment that we're practicing mindfulness is going to be like that. But I think that it points to something about how the embodied experience together with the mental experience could click in such a way that there was just a different sensibility about it. So for this reason also, mindfulness has been compared to like a flashlight. Like, oh, whoa, suddenly, right? There is a very different degree of clarity and experience of what's been there all the time. It's not that there was anything that I was particularly adding to that situation. And so there's also a sense of waking up to something new as well, right? To waking up to a kind of curiosity that could be renewed or new in each moment. A kind of not knowing what's there, even after all these years, even after lots of travel or education or concepts or whatever it is that you think you know, history, experience, whatever it is that you think you know. So there's a freshness and a beauty and a compellingness in that simplicity. In that simplicity. And recently I was revisiting this very pithy little book, which I recommend if I haven't already. This very pithy but handy, and I would say wise book by Bhikkhu Bodhi on the Noble Eightfold Path. So if you're following along with the nuns on the Noble Eightfold Path, this is a very good one. It's just called that, The Noble Eightfold Path, The Way to the End of Suffering by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he says quite clearly about right mindfulness, he says, the task of mindfulness is to clear up the cognitive field, period. To clear up the cognitive field. So that's a very interesting perspective on it, right? So he's not saying that we learn some kind of methodology in terms of becoming mindful. Do you see what I'm saying? There isn't like a methodology, there isn't a task at hand necessarily. Mindfulness itself is clearing the cognitive field. So let me go back to a little bit to that. So we're talking about sati, is the Pali word. Hopefully many of you know this, and we said it in the chant, sammasati. Right or sound mindfulness. And it's a kind of heightened form of awareness, or you could call it an attentiveness to experience, a kind of presence, kind of clear presence, in the moment. So it implies an in-the-momentness, a present moment, a bringing oneself here and not being in the past, not being in the future, It also implies a certain kind of non-judgmental quality. We're not talking about interpreting what happened or deciding whether it's okay or not okay or how to respond or any of those things. Mindfulness is before that. Those kinds of things might be part of investigation, for example. So if we're thinking in terms of the seven factors, right, of awakening, mindfulness being the first and investigation being the second, as they're typically taught. But mindfulness is, as I said, so shining the attention like a flashlight in a particular way. Or the traditional metaphor that's used in the discourses. Of course, mindfulness is all throughout the discourses. But one particular metaphor that I really enjoy, that I think can be helpful for us, is to think about the watch person who stands at the gate to the city. Right? Stands on the top of the wall at the gate to the city. And just watch person, right? They are not counting horses or deciding that that person can't go out or, you know, any other activity. It's just observing what comes in and what comes out. So again, pointing at this kind of this interactivity that we experience in every single moment of contact between what we perceive as our inner world and what we perceive as outer world. And that's important. I'll talk about that in just a minute. But I want to also emphasize that mindfulness requires a certain kind of precision. It's not a vague, you know, general kind of, yeah, I'm aware of my situation. It requires a certain kind of precision. And I'll tell you a little story about that. And some of you may have heard this story already, so for that I apologize. But we'll try to give it a little spin. I try to give it a little different spin each time, so we'll see how it goes. So I was co-leading a year-long program for lay folks who were practitioners affiliated, so loosely speaking, with San Francisco Zen Center. One of five teachers who was co-leading a year-long program out there. And so there were 60 people in the program, and so each one of us had 12 folks in our sort of subgroup, and we would meet with our subgroup a couple times a month, and then they would meet with each other once a week. And so we would give them some general overarching theme for each month of the year, for the 12 months of the year. But we were just getting started out the first month of the year. And so we gave everybody a homework assignment, and the homework assignment was to figure out which foot you put in your skirt or your shorts or your kilt or your dress or your sarong or whatever it is, which foot you put in first in your clothes in the morning, right? Simple mindfulness of body exercise. So we gave this to everybody as a homework. And about week 5 or 6, so we were moving on to the second topic. And I don't recall what the second topic was, but one of the women in my subgroup came to me about week 5 or 6. And she was a young woman. She'd been practicing for a number of years, maybe 3 or 4 years. She, you know, felt like she should be able to do this homework. And she said to me, Here I am, week 5. I still have not figured out which foot I put in my skirt. I get up, I get into the car to go to work, and I go, oh my gosh, again, I have not yet figured out which foot I put in. And I just, I don't know why I can't get this, but I can't really get this yet. So we had a little talk. So we had to talk about what? We had to talk about habit, the habits that we have, and how habit is kind of covering up our everyday. We think that it's making things easier, but actually what habit is doing is separating us from the experience of the moment. So we talked a little bit about habit. We talked a little bit about slowing down, right? It's a busy time. She had a young child. She had a 3-year-old little girl at that point. So, and she was working out of the house. Her husband was also working out of the house. So it was a busy time in the morning, right? First thing, people were trying to get everything going. So we talked a little bit about slowing down, and we talked a little bit about what else? Being present for the moment before the moment you want to observe. Right? Because it's easier with a little bit of continuity, actually, than it is to just turn on the mindfulness at one particular spot. If you have a little bit of continuity, you're more likely to catch it there in the flow. So we talked about all these things, and then, sure enough, about, 10 days later or so, she came back and she said, "Guess what?" I said, "What?" She said, "I figured it out. My tendency is that I put my left foot in my skirt first in the morning. And that's not the coolest thing." I said, "Oh, so what's the coolest thing?" And the coolest thing is that my daughter, my 3-year-old daughter, also puts her left foot in first. That is pretty cool, right? And again, so what is she seeing? So she's learned something about her own mindfulness of her mindfulness of her own body, right? Mindfulness of her own inner world. She's learned that she can practice right in the midst of busy lay life, umpteen things going on all at the same time, maybe the most stressful moment of the day, even that period of time there of getting everybody ready to get out the door. But she's also learned something about the world that she lives in and about intimacy with this little being, and maybe even a little bit less stress or conflict each morning that she can hand her the left leg of her pants first. Huh? Beautiful. So beautiful. So there's a tremendous potential. There's a tremendous potential that mindfulness brings. Again, without adding a single thing, but our intentionality. Our willingness to be there for what's happening. To tune into what's actually happening. And there's a freedom, actually, from the habit pattern, of mind also, right? So she had been just kind of on autopilot all that time and not even realizing that until that moment of seeing the left foot, you know? So, very, very beautiful, and a story that I love to tell, and one that, again, I think demonstrates the way in which mindfulness is not just about some kind of mental turning or some kind of mental observation, right? But the whole picture of how we're interacting with our environment. So going beyond, it has the potential to help us go beyond the preoccupation with self. So traditionally, the way that right mindfulness is defined is the 4 satipatthana, the 4 foundations of mindfulness. And that's why we started out with the foot in the shorts exercise, right? Because the first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of body. As the Buddha described it, right? So he gives several practices in the Satipatthana in terms of becoming aware of the breath. And then he talks about a study of the features, the actual organs and fluids and things of the body, right? Thinking about the anatomy of a human being. So interesting, right? So interesting. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on the detail of that, but we can come back to that if people are interested. So one is anatomy and looking at the organs. Suffice to say that if we open it up, it's not quite as cuddly as it seems to us from the outside, right? That's part of the point of that. And then there's four elements. Four elements: earth, air, fire, and water. That's a very excellent meditation to do. Four elements. So looking at the body as composed of those things, but then also the recognition that all things outside of us are also, as defined in Buddhism, also those things, earth, air, fire, and water, those qualities, so solidity and a kind of softness or fluidity and temperature, or also chemistry, like digestion, that's part of the fire element. And then air representing movement, and also to some extent representing space. Space and consciousness was added later, or we think added later, according to the scholars, in the Agamas and the Chinese versions of the text. But in the Pali, what we see are the four. And then the other study of the body, mindfulness of body, and the Satipatthana is the corpse meditations. So thinking about the inevitability of our own death. This is not for everyone, let me say that. It's not something that you should do without the support of others. And if it brings up a lot of fear or despair, then definitely set it down. Even in the Buddhist time, there are some suttas about folks who had a difficult time with that particular teaching. But I think that the reality, one of the things that I have been very heartened to see, particularly as someone who later after my Japanese training had chose to go and spend some years in chaplaincy, both in the hospital and in hospice, one of the things that I'm heartened to see is that there's more conversation about death in American society now than there used to be. I think that that's something that's becoming a little bit more approachable, that conversation. So mindfulness of body, and then shifting from mindfulness of body, the next one is mindfulness of feeling. That's the second of the four foundations. So those ones that I just mentioned were all together in the first foundation, mindfulness of body, and then second foundation is mindfulness of feeling. And I brought my only and therefore my favorite prop that I use for Dharma talks, which is the contact, what I call the contact ball. That's right, you come look there, Bill. So feeling arises out of contact. And what is contact? The Buddha said contact is when you have a sense organ and a sense object, the object that goes with that particular sense organ, and conscious awareness. When those three come together, then there's something called contact, right? So just as we were doing in the meditation earlier, that's why we did a six senses meditation. So you have the ear, and then when there's a sound that comes into contact with the ear and a consciousness, that's important that there's some conscious awareness, right? So if you're asleep, for example, there might not be a conscious awareness of the sound happening there. So that's not a contact that's going to bring up the same kind of feeling tone. Or if you are in a coma, for example, in fact, one of the ways that medically people are defined to be dead is when we contact them, we do things like, we, the doctors, do things like poke them or do a clap or something and see that there's no brain activity that responds to that. That's one of our approximations for awareness is brain activity, but don't be limited to that by any stretch. In any event, the contact ball. So this is what happens. So you have an ear, you have a sound meets your ear, and then you have a awareness of that. And then what happens is that, according to the Buddha, you have a moment of ear consciousness. And that ear consciousness starts, and then it changes. It does its little thing. It's not the same the whole time, but then it has a definite ending. Right? So you have a moment of consciousness, of each kind of sense consciousness. And this is also why we looked at the mind. We sat with the mind as an organ of consciousness, because there can also be feeling tones, right? So feeling tones are whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Feeling tones associated with what? With thoughts as mind phenomena. Right. So studying feeling tones, that's your second foundation of mindfulness. And then the third foundation of mindfulness is mind, mindfulness of mind. This one, that's a big topic. I'm going to probably talk about that tonight with the Berkeley Sangha. So if you don't have anything else to do the rest of the day, you always tune in later, 6:30 tonight with the Berkeley Sangha. Mindfulness of mind is something along the lines of, you could say, the characteristics or the attributes of mind. Different from mind states. Usually mind states would be in the fourth character, in the fourth Satipatthana, which are the dhammas, right? Referred to as the dhammas. So the dhammas are typically, again, looking at the agama, slightly different than they are in the Pali texts, but the two categories, the two areas that we see in all of the parallels are the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. And looking at those, what we see is that one way that I'd like to sum them up is to say it's looking at states of mind that lead to greater suffering or states of mind that lead to freedom from suffering. That's the fourth Satipatthana. And the third one, again, looking at the attributes of mind or the characteristics of mind. It's mind, you might say, as the container for those states, the kind of mind which can be, for example, one of the attributes that's mentioned by the Buddha in the Satipatthana is it a mind that's constrained, or is it a mind that's open? Is it a mind that's confused, deluded, or is it a mind that's liberated? So mindfulness of mind is looking at, you could say, the general characteristic of a mind in the moment. So one way to think about that, one way to touch into that, it's not a Satipatthana practice, but in the Brahma-Vihara practice, right? If you're doing a radiating Brahma-Vihara, that's your mind, that idea of the light going out. That's your mind. Right? So at the end of a Brahma-Vihara, to come back to a reflection of, oh, how is the mind now? This incredibly vast, bright, joyous mind of a Brahma-Vihara. Right? Not a particular state. It's not thinking about one thing or another. It has that attribute, though, of the luminosity. So now I've already run over my time, and goodness knows, as I said, there's so much more that could be said, but I want to say thank you all for your presence and your practice, and please be well and take care of one another and be safe and be mindful. Noam, shall I chant a blessing or shall we hop off? I want to respect people's time, so it's up to you. I can't hear you.
I think it would be wonderful if you would chant a blessing. Can I just say a word about
sure.
San Francisco?
Yeah.
In case anyone is new here, I think I recognize everyone, but I'm not sure. So thank you. Am I hard to hear?
There you go. Now that's better.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Venerable Dhamma Deepa.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.